And gentlemen, you're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining me today for readings of interest to the Jewish community. My name is Michael Wolin. I have a variety of articles I'd like to read today. I hope you find them interesting. We're going to have a Dvar Torah, Words from the Torah, by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks. He's going to talk about Parsha Pinchas. I have an article about what's going on in Surfside, Florida, the tragedy of this apartment building that collapsed. 150 people, approximately, are still missing there. I have an article about President Biden and the Iran nuclear issue, liberal Jews and Ilhan Omar, representative from Michigan, and there was a Chabad rabbi who was stabbed in outside of his classroom, kind of an unbelievable sort of a thing, and maybe a few others if I have the time. Let me get started with Lessons of a Leader. That's what Rabbi Yonatan Sacks titles his commentary, his drosh on Parsha Pinchas, Book of Numbers. He says, the Parsha of Pinchas contains a master class on leadership. As Moses confronts his own mortality and asks God to appoint a successor, the great leaders care about succession. In Parsha Chaye Sarah, we saw Abraham instruct his servant to find a wife for his son, Isaac. And he wanted to do that so that the family of the covenant will continue. King David chose Solomon. Elijah, at God's bidding, appointed Elisha to carry on his work. In the case of Moses, the sages sensed a certain sadness at his realization that he would not be succeeded by either of his sons, surviving sons, Gershom or Eliezer. Such is the case with Keter Torah, the invisible crown of Torah worn by the prophets and the sages. Unlike the crowns of priesthood and kingship, it does not pass dynastically from father to son. Charisma rarely does. What is instructive, though, is the language Moses uses in framing his request. May the Lord, God of the spirits of all flesh, choose a person over the congregation who will go out before them and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep without a shepherd. There's three basic leadership lessons to be learned from this choice of words. The first, noted by Rashi, is implicit in the unusually long description of God as the Lord God of the spirits of all flesh. This means, as Rashi explains, the master of the universe, the character of each person is revealed to you, and no two are alike. Appoint over them a leader who will bear with each person according to their individual character. The Rambam says this is a basic feature of the human condition. Homo sapiens is the most diverse of all life forms. Therefore, cooperation is essential, because we are each different. Others are strong where we are weak, and vice versa. But cohesion is also difficult, because we each respond to challenges in different ways. This is what makes leadership necessary, and it also what makes leadership demanding. This great variety and the necessity of social life are essential elements in human nature, but the well-being of society demands there should be a leader able to regulate the actions of each person. They must complete every shortcoming, remove every excess, and prescribe for the conduct of all, so that the natural variety should be counterbalanced by the uniformity of legislation, and the order of society should be well established. Leaders respect differences, but like the conductor of an orchestra, they integrate them, ensuring that the many different instruments play their part in harmony with the rest. True leaders do not seek to impose uniformity. They honor diversity. The second hint is contained in the word ish, the Hebrew word ish, a person, over the congregation to which God responds, "Take for yourself Joshua, a person, an ish, of spirit." The word ish here indicates something other than gender. This can be seen in two places where the Torah uses the phrase Ha'ish Moshe, the man Moses. One is in Exodus. The man Moses was highly respected. They called him a Gadol Me'od, literally very great, in the land of Egypt, in the eyes of Pharaoh's servants and the people. The second is in Numbers. Now the man Moses was very humble, called a man Anav Me'od, more so than anyone else on the face of the earth. Note the two characteristics seemingly opposed, very great and humble, both of which Moses had in high degree. Me'od means very. This is the combination of attributes Rabbi Yochanan attributed to God himself. Wherever you find God's greatness, there you find his humility. Here is one of his proof texts. Quote, "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the orphan and the widow, and loves the stranger residing among you, and giving them food and clothing." An ish in the context of leadership is not a male, but rather someone who is a mensch, a person whose greatness is lightly worn, who cares about the people others often ignore, the orphan, the widow, and the stranger, who spends as much time with the people at the margins of society as with the elites, who is courteous to everyone equally, and who receives respect because they give respect. The real puzzlement, however, lies in the third clause. Choose a person over the congregation who will go out before them and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in. This sounds like saying the same thing twice, which the Korah tends not to do. What does it mean? The Torah is hinting here at one of the most challenging aspects of leadership, namely timing and pace. The first phrase is simple. Who will go out before them and come in before them? This means that a leader must lead from the front. They cannot be like the apocryphal remark of one British politician, "Of course I follow the party. After all, I am their leader." And nor can it be like our former President Barack Obama, who believed he was doing the best job he could, leading from behind. It's the second phrase that's vital. Who will lead them out and bring them in? This means a leader must lead from the front. But that person should not be so far out in front that when they turn around, they find that no one is following. Pace is of the essence. Sometimes a leader can go too fast, and that is when tragedies occur. To take two very different examples, when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister, she knew she was going to have to confront the miners' union in a long and bitter struggle. In 1981, they went on strike for a pay raise. Mrs. Thatcher immediately made inquiries about the size of coal stocks. She wanted to know how long this country could survive without new supplies of coal. As soon as she discovered that the stocks were quite low, she, in effect, conceded victory to the miners. Then, very quietly, she arranged for coal to be stockpiled. The result was that when the miners went on strike again in 1983, 2 years later, she resisted their demands. There was a prolonged strike, and this time it was the miners who conceded defeat. A battle she could not win in 1981, she was able to win in 1983. A very different example was that of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. The peace process he engaged with the Palestinians between 1993 and 1995 was deeply controversial within Israel and beyond. There was some support, but also much opposition. The tension mounted in 1995. In September of that year, I wrote an article in the press giving him my own personal support. At the same time, however, I wrote to him privately, saying that I was deeply worried about internal opposition to the plan, and urging him to spend as much time negotiating with his fellow Israeli citizens, specifically the religious Zionists, as with the Palestinians. I did not receive a reply. On Motzi Shabbos, the 4th of November, 1995, we heard the news that Prime Minister Rabin had been assassinated at a peace rally by a young religious Zionist. I attended the funeral in Jerusalem. Returning the next day, I went straight from the airport to the Israeli ambassador to sit with him and talk to him about the funeral, which he had not been able to attend, having had to stay in London to deal with the media. As I entered his office, he handed me an envelope saying, "This has just arrived for you in the diplomatic bag." It was Yitzhak Rabin's reply to my letter, one of the last letters he ever wrote. It was a moving reaffirmation of his faith, but tragically, by the time it was delivered, he was no longer alive. He had pursued peace, as we are commanded to do, but he had gone too fast for those not yet prepared to listen. Moses knew this himself from the episode of the spies. As Maimonides says in The Guide, the task of fighting battles and conquering the land was just too much for a generation born to slavery. It could only be done by their children, those born in freedom. Sometimes a journey that seems small on the map takes 40 years. Respect for diversity, care for the lowly and powerlessness, as well as the powerful and the great, and the willingness to go no faster than people can bear. These are three essential attributes of a leader, as Moses knew from experience, and as Joshua learned through long apprenticeship to the great man himself. Well, there you have some comments by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, former chief rabbi of Great Britain, on the Parsha for the week, Pinchas, the lessons of a leader. Well, I'm sure that everyone hearing this is familiar with the condominium collapse, the high-rise collapse in Florida, Surfside. There was, the confirmed dead now is 18, and there is almost 150 people still missing. And every day they are digging in the rubble trying to find survivors. Well, the Israelis are there, and they were there within hours, really very few hours, 72 hours. I think there was an Israeli team on the ground ready to go to work. And so this article is just a little bit about what they're doing and how it's going on. The opening paragraph says that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force Home Front Command, is using a visual intelligence techniques and information from families to map out the destroyed condo in Surfside and to help identify the disaster's victims. A rescue delegation from the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces Home Front Command, is using visual intelligence techniques to map out this wreckage of this condo to help identify potential victims. This mapping out method is enabling rescue teams to more quickly reach the remains of victims and identify them accurately, according to military representatives. In recent days, additional members of the Home Front Command joined the delegation on the ground in Surfside, Florida, including rescuers, engineers, and population behavior officers. To assist the efforts, members of an analysis team from the IDF Intelligence Directorate's Unit 9990, which specializes in visual intelligence, built a three-dimensional map of the collapsed building. This is streamlining the process of finding missing persons at the disaster site. The first Israeli delegation arrived at the disaster zone within 72 hours of the building's collapse. Now, it is made up of 15 members who are both helping first responders using the 3D mapping and conducting a humanitarian effort to support the families of the missing. The IDF says that the activity of this Home Front Command delegation will continue as long as it is needed. In recent days, the unit's members have been using advanced technological capabilities to assist the Home Front Command delegation in Miami. We analyzed the collapsed building and built a three-dimensional model of the structure. Our model will allow the Home Front Command delegation to further assist in rescue efforts and navigate through the rubble more quickly and effectively. We are grateful for the privilege and responsibility to take part in such an important international effort. So said Lieutenant Soul. His name is withheld. He's the commander of the 9900 team on the ground in Florida. IDF International spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Amnon Scheffler told journalists that in the hours after the initial collapse on June 25th, the whole of the Home Front Command was following events, thinking what it can do as it saw things unfold on TV. On Saturday, after being invited by the governor of Florida to send a delegation, the team was at the airport within 3 hours, and within two more hours, it took off for Miami. It landed and went directly to the site, working in two shifts of 12 hours each. Seven more officers then joined the team. There are five American agencies working together in dealing with the complex, tragic disaster. The building was 40 years old, with 12 apartments on each floor of different sizes. There were 196 people living in the building. Due to the late hour, unfortunately, most of the people were home. The visual intelligence capabilities are enabling rescue forces to know who was in which room at the moment of the collapse and to know how many people to search for in each apartment. The team has generated 12-digit coordinates of the current location of each room, meaning they have an accurate mapping estimation with a margin of error of 1 meter, 3 feet. The analysis also created a stage-by-stage simulation of the collapse, which assists in the tracking down process of the rooms and the victims. Based on that, they know exactly where to find the people. The rescue teams are working very accurately, going to specific places and making efforts to be more accurate and efficient. We can say with a lot of sadness that more bodies were found because of that, said Scheffler. Speaking from Florida via Zoom, the Home Front Command Civilian Population Officer, Major Uri Yashvi, said he was part of the second installment of the Israeli delegation, which landed in Miami on Tuesday. The family center established by Rescue Services briefs relatives of the victims twice a day, and the Home Front Command team is playing a role in questioning the families to help gather information about who was located in each room of the apartment. In addition, we're gathering information that will help us identify the people, such as what they were wearing, what did they look like, the artifacts next to them. This will help us to understand who we will reach. The mission of the Israeli delegation, which is under the command of the head of the National Rescue Unit of the Home Front Command, Reserve Colonel Golan Vach, missions also include assisting the Jewish community in identifying victims and survivors, as well as supporting local rescue forces. The team is using a blueprint of the collapsed building. The technology combined with population information techniques definitely helps identify what floor and room in which we arrive, said Yashvi. And if we have the description from the family or photos, we compare that to what we see in the field. And in that way, they're able to identify who should be where in the building and go to that location. Very interesting. There's approximately 80 people working in shifts, so that at any given time there are about 80 people working on this project, working on this disaster. And the number changes, but at least 15, which is approximately 20%, at any given time are Israelis. And of course there are many Jewish people also involved in rescue who are not Israelis but are there participating. So there's a bit of an inside look at the Israeli rescue effort in Surfside, Florida. Well, let me turn to an article by Jonathan Tobin, International Affairs, and our ongoing tete-a-tete with the country of Iran. They want nuclear weapons, and they want to attack Israel. And for the last 4 years of the previous administration, it was very clear that that wasn't going to happen, at least not the way they intended it, because the Trump administration did everything it could to slow, if not stop, the Iranian push for nuclear weapons. But the Obama administration is, excuse me, the Biden administration is different. They want to re-engage with Iran. They want to lift sanctions. In other words, they're willing to facilitate Tehran in its drive for nuclear weapons. So here's a little commentary on this. The president, that's President Biden, pledged that Tehran will not acquire nuclear weapons on his watch. But if he reinstates Obama's deal, the crisis will occur after he leaves office. So it's quite safe for him to say no nuclear weapons on his watch. The intent is that it will happen later. Outgoing Israeli President Reuven Rivlin met with U.S. President Biden in Washington this week, and Foreign Minister Yair Lapid met with Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Rome. The theme of both meetings, as far as the Israelis were concerned, was happiness with the Biden administration. As far as Rivlin and Lapid are concerned, any problems facing the alliance were the fault of former Prime Minister Netanyahu, whom both men despise, despite coming from different ends of the Israeli political spectrum. Lapid went out of his way to declare that mistakes were made by Netanyahu, whose policies towards Democrats he described as shameful and dangerous. Rivlin was equally eager to portray Biden as a reliable friend of Israel who should be taken at his word when he makes promises about protecting its security. That's exactly what the administration wants to hear, even if the attempt to depict the Democrats as having been wronged by Netanyahu is inaccurate. After all, it was former President Obama who undermined the alliance between the two democracies with his appeasement of Iran, which Netanyahu was right to oppose, and castigating Netanyahu for embracing the historic tilt of the Trump administration and the Republicans towards Israel is equally senseless. But dunking on Netanyahu isn't the real objective of the current Israeli government, no matter how much its members may enjoy it. Their goal is to use the change in power in Jerusalem to somehow reset relations with the United States so as to sway Biden to avoid going down the same reckless path on Iran as Obama. And if toadying to Biden and Blinken is all it would take to accomplish that important mission, then they are right to attempt it. The top foreign policy priority of any Israeli government, no matter who is at its head, is to stay as close to their superpower ally as possible. Trying to reinforce the notion that support for Israel is a matter of bipartisan consensus is also vital, even if the clear split among Democrats on the issue, and not anything Israel and the pro-Israel community has or hasn't done, is what is undermining it. Even those most inclined to regard the generational shift among Democrats as irreversible need to understand that the Israelis should do what they can to reach out to the still considerable portion of that party that is friendly to the Jewish state. The aging Democratic establishment that has strong ties to Israel is clearly more afraid of the Squad and their party's left-wing base, who buy into intersectional myths about Israel being an apartheid state, than they are of the pro-Israel community. But for now, Biden and establishment figures like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer are the ones with the most influence, and Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, along with Lapid, needs to cultivate them. Kind words and boilerplate rhetoric about preserving the alliance from Biden and Blinken are to be welcomed, not least because they serve to discourage their party's anti-Israel left-wing celebrities like Representative Ilhan Omar, more about her in another article, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and those foreign powers like Iran who hope to isolate and eliminate the Jewish state. But a concerted effort to curry favor with the administration shouldn't cause anyone, least of all Bennett or Lapid, to succumb to wishful thinking. That's because Biden's promises about Israeli security and the threat from Iran that pleased Rivlin so much are basically worthless. The most disappointing comment to come out of these discussions is one that many friends of Israel are hoping to hang their hats on. Biden's promise, in which he said, "What I can say to you is that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch." That remark made for hopeful headlines in Israeli publications after it was made. Indeed, it would seem to be exactly the sort of pledge that those who care about the effort to halt the Islamist regime's push, not just for nukes, but for regional hegemony, wanted him to say. But the catch is, on my watch, part of the promise. The weak Biden agreement, Obama, with supposedly the support of pro-Israel figures like Biden and the rest of the current president's foreign policy team, that agreement reached with Iran had many flaws, including ignoring Iran's terrorism and building of illegal missiles, but the worst was its time frame. The deal, which went into effect in 2015, was loaded with sunset clauses that the Iranians insisted upon. These provisions caused all of the restrictions on its nuclear program to expire within 10 to 15 years. Obama convinced most Democrats, including many who claimed to be supporters of Israel, that kicking the can down the road in this way was the best deal that could be made. They, along with Obama's dupes in the media, accurately labeled an echo chamber by his aide, Ben Rhodes, also bought into the idea that the only choices America faced was appeasement or war. 6 years later, the clock is ticking, and the West needs to face up to the fact that by the end of the decade, the Iran deal will expire in any case, and the Israel-hating theocrats that run it will have a legal, clear path to a nuclear weapon. That's something that former President Trump understood when he withdrew from the deal and embarked on an effort to force Iran to renegotiate a pact that would permanently foreclose the nuclear option, as well as halt its support for terrorism and missile building. In doing this, he debunked Obama's false choice with a successful policy of sanctions that put maximum pressure on Iran and crippled its economy but avoided war. Biden and Blinken have acknowledged this problem. They say they will reinstate the nuclear agreement first and then cajole Iran into negotiating and signing a new deal that will do exactly what Trump sought to do while preventing Tehran from engaging in any nuclear shenanigans in the meantime. But the Israeli officials who are both kissing up to the Democratic administration, while also quietly lobbying them to change course, know that that plan is a mission impossible. Simply put, the inducements, including the lifting of sanctions that the U.S. is offering Iran to get them back into the deal, means it is giving up all of the leverage over the regime it inherited from Trump's maximum pressure campaign. Once the 2015 pact is reinstated and Iran is able to reap the financial rewards involved in the lifting of sanctions, Biden will have no way to force the Ayatollahs to reverse their pledge or even to renegotiate any of its terms. That will mean that Iran's consistent cheating on the agreement notwithstanding, Biden will be able to fulfill his promise about them not getting a nuclear weapon on his watch, even if he runs and then wins re-election and serves until January 29. It will be the American president who was elected in November 28 who will be faced with a nuclear Iran on that president's watch. That's why all the fine promises made this week about Israel's security being sacrosanct and nothing horrible happening while Biden and Blinken have anything to say about it are as worthless as Obama's claim that his signature foreign policy achievement would allow Iran a path to, quote, get right with the world. It is the president's bad policies that matter, not his friendly words. Unless Biden changes course on Iran, Israeli efforts to ingratiate those Democrats who still care about their security will be a fool's errand. Well, we have an administration whose head is, meaning President Biden, is not there most of the time. And the remainder of the people that you don't see behind the scenes are intelligent, capable, ruthless ideologues. And they believe what they believe for ideological reasons, not practical policy considerations. And that means that it's a dangerous time for America. And war is very, very difficult to think about. I'm talking about a war not of our choosing, but of our enemy's choosing. And unfortunately, the policies of the present administration seem to many to make that possibility even more likely. Well, that's Jonathan Tobin writing on Biden's promise on Iranian nuclear weapons is essentially worthless. And I mentioned Ilhan Omar. And why is the administration so frightened of the squad, Ilhan Omar, and occasional Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, and others? Why do they cover for them? Why are they so intimidated by them? Why liberal Jews especially still covering for Ilhan Omar? Well, Tobin offers a few ideas. He writes that the latest trolling of the Jews by the Minnesota congresswoman exposes the failure of many Jewish groups and Democrats to prioritize the fight against anti-Semitism over their partisan affiliations. Another way to say ideological dogma. The interesting thing about Representative Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, is not that she can't stop trolling American Jews, the pro-Israel community, and even her Jewish colleagues in the House Democratic Caucus. Omar has demonstrated again and again she's a dedicated ideologue who is committed to anti-Zionist politics and never shy about employing anti-Semitic tropes to advance that cause. The really interesting thing about her is why so many liberal Jews, Jewish organizations, even Jewish members of Congress, are not only afraid to stand up to her, but often bend over backwards to justify or rationalize her outrageous behavior. Yet, this explains a great deal about how a largely dysfunctional, organized Jewish world has failed to respond effectively to a surge of anti-Semitism emanating from the left wing of the Democratic Party. In other words, from their own voters. Every new instance of Omar's trolling of the Jews follows a familiar pattern. She generates outrage by saying something offensive, seems to retreat when she gets pushback, and then almost immediately turns around and doubles down on her original comments, then counterattacks, depicting herself as a victim, and anyone who had the temerity, the audacity, to criticize her as a racist, an Islamophobe, and an opponent of justice. She then reaps the rewards of adulation from the leftist base of the Democratic Party, which is growing all the time, and its cheering section in the mainstream media and popular culture. That's what happened back in 2019, when, upon entering Congress as one of the four members of the radical leftist squad, she said Jews were buying congressional support for Israel. The way she said it was, it's all about the Benjamins. That was a double-pronged attack aimed at delegitimizing the pro-Israel community and fellow members of Congress, both Jewish and non-Jewish, for supposedly selling their votes for Jewish money. It played out this way again only weeks ago, when, after falsely denouncing Israeli measures of self-defense against Hamas terrorism and damning it as an apartheid state, she went on to make a specious comparison between both Israel and the United States to Palestinian terrorists and the Taliban. After receiving criticism, including from a dozen Jewish Democrats who called on her to clarify her remarks without actually condemning her, she appeared to back down, saying she had been taken out of context, giving Democratic leaders like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi the opening needed to declare the controversy over. But then, in almost the same breath, Omar denounced those who had sought to call her to account as bigots, and was strongly defended by the House Progressive Caucus and others on the left, who were no more offended by her appalling comments than they are by her support for the anti-Semitic BDS movement. Yet given an opportunity to try to conciliate her critics when asked about the most recent dust-up in an interview with Jake Tapper on CNN, Omar did the opposite. She denounced the 12 Jewish Democrats who took a stand against her as people who are not seeking, quote, justice around the world. That she considers her support for Hamas war to eliminate the one Jewish state on the planet as a fight for justice is a form of gaslighting. But one has to admire the clever ways she always seeks to put liberal Jews on the wrong foot and succeeds by accusing them of being insufficiently loyal to the social justice agenda which is at the core of her political identity. To that end, Omar quickly pivoted from anti-Semitic invective to an attempt to laud Jews, to praise them for their past support for justice. In a tweet thread in which she again burnished her credentials as a woman of color and an immigrant, quote, who survived war and witnessed injustice firsthand, and then proceeded to play a different Jewish card by citing the involvement of Jews in the civil rights movement. That's in the past, in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. The implication of this was that those who take issue with her support for an anti-Semitic war on Israel are betraying the legacy of people like Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But it was also an attempt to position herself as an advocate for a black Jewish alliance on social justice, rather than, as she really is, an extremist politician who traffics in anti-Semitism and whose invective and incitement can be linked to the surge in attacks on Jews across the United States in the wake of her statements about Israel. Well, not everyone is falling for this. The Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations roundly condemned her for what it rightly termed her anti-Semitic accusations. David Harris, head of the American Jewish Committee, similarly took her to task in a Newsweek column for having a problem with Jews. But what has to be the most galling for those who are put in her crosshairs is the way so many Jews who identify as progressives are not only willing to give her a pass, but are actively assisting her campaign against Israel, its supporters, and any Democrat who has the guts to notice what she's doing. For example, Rabbi Jonah Pessner, head of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, who had nothing to say about Omar's attacks on Israel and Jews, but he actually endorsed her attempt to co-opt Jewish history in her defense with a fawning tweet, "Thank you, Representative Omar, for lifting up this history. We need our community standing together in the fight for justice and against anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim bigotry," he wrote. With the leader of the political arm of the largest Jewish denomination in America behind her, Haaretz was right to claim in a headline that Jewish Democrats back Ilhan Omar. Nor were they alone. Two Jewish members of the House Democratic Caucus, Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota and Dave Sicilione of Rhode Island, also spoke up in her defense, with the latter claiming all the fuss was the work of right-wingers who were trying to create a controversy where there was none. Haley Sofer, head of the Jewish Democratic Council of America, which has recently signaled that its mission is to advocate for both Israel and Palestinian rights amid the Hamas attacks on Israel, also strongly welcomed Omar's comments. It should be remembered that the majority of House Jewish Democrats chose to be silent or actually support Omar rather than join with those who condemned her comparison of Israel to a terrorist group. It isn't only progressives who seek to cozy up to anti-Semites. This past week, Representative Paul Gosar, Republican from Arizona, was called out for planning to host a fundraiser with alt-right, anti-Semite, and Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes, who has previously been shunned by mainstream conservatives. Like Omar, when she was asked about her Benjamin slur, Gosar claimed ignorance of who he was dealing with. But the point here is that Jewish Republicans were quick to condemn Gosar rather than to support him. By contrast, progressives are blinded both by their partisan aversion to taking on their ideological allies like Omar, but also often effectively silenced by her status as a woman of color. The Jewish left has bought into these toxic myths of critical race theory and intersectionality, and are so conscious of having white privilege to the point where they are simply incapable of realizing the connection between leftists and attacks on Jews and Israel. That inability to spurn anyone, no matter how egregious their behavior, who can fit into a race category that denotes oppressed status, acts as a permission slip for Jew hatred that Omar is happy to accept. That Omar is effectively given a pass by the media, including Jews like Jake Tapper, who failed to challenge her attack on Jews in his interview with her, is bad enough. But that progressive Jews are still lining up with her tells you everything you need to know about the partisan sickness and ideological madness that is doing such terrible damage to the country's political culture. And the vanguard, in many instances, are Jews in the Congress, powerful Jews, Jews head of Jewish organizations, things like that. They facilitate these kinds of behavior. Well, that's Jonathan Tobin asking the question, why are liberal Jews still covering for Ilhan Omar? I can't say the answer is satisfying to one man's opinion, but it's such a strange thing. Every other ethnic minority, it seems, has to deal with its hate groups. They exist. But the Jewish community is different, and they have to deal with self-hate groups. Really a very, very bizarre kind of a phenomenon. Well, not to beat the horse about anti-Semitism. It's alive, it's well, it's growing. It's very real. It's real in America. It doesn't exist over there. It exists right here. And here's a story about a Boston Chabad rabbi who was stabbed for doing nothing. He simply was there. Well, begin this article with a quote by the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Boston's, executive director. His name is Jeremy Burton, who says, at a time of rising violence, anti-Semitism across this country, no Jew, no building, no part of our community, no neighborhood will stand alone. Well, hundreds of people attended a united rally in Boston Friday to show their solidarity with the Jewish community one day after a Chabad rabbi was stabbed outside a Jewish day school. Rabbi Shlomo Noginsky was sitting on the steps outside the Shalom House, which was in use as a summer camp, when 24-year-old Khaled Awad allegedly came over with a gun in his hand and asked the rabbi to lead him to his car. When they reached the car, Noginsky ran, but not before being stabbed 8 times. He was treated at a local hospital. Boston police said that Awad is expected to be arraigned in Brighton District Court on charges of assault and battery by means of a dangerous weapon and assault and battery on a police officer. Why it is an attempted murder is a mystery to me, but those are the charges. Well, while the motive is unclear to many of the people in the news media, I would say, ADL, that's the Anti-Defamation League, New England Regional Director Robert Treston said, facts were emerging that included multiple indicators pointing towards anti-Semitism. Well, that's earth-shocking. Who would have ever thought that? At Friday morning's rally, which was co-sponsored by the Combined Jewish Philanthropies and Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Boston, the council's director, Jeremy Burton, said the Jewish community is angry and the Jewish community is united. At a time of rising violence, anti-Semitism across this country, no Jew, no building, no part of our community, no neighborhood will stand alone. And we expect, we demand that we have the right to live, to walk in the streets, to be visible, to gather together, to celebrate and live our lives as Jews fully, with joy and without fear. We look to our public and appointed officials to ensure the Jews have that ability to live and be free in this country in all the ways we've been promised and come to expect in the last 200 years. You can't find a person who is kinder, more humble, and more sincere than Noginsky. Rodkin recalled how his friend was born in Russia and was just 10 years old when he was beaten very badly by hooligans who told him to tell his mother and all the Jews to leave Russia. His mother, a famous pianist, immediately enrolled her son in martial arts classes before managing to seek asylum with her children and moving to Israel. There, Noginsky studied in a Chabad school, married, and moved to the village of Kfar Chabad, where he had a business and was involved in local government, according to Rodkin. Wanting to teach Russian Jews about the Torah and Judaism, Noginsky sold his business and moved his family to Boston. Today, he's a proud Jew, a rabbi, and a proud father of 12 incredible children. Noting that Noginsky was stabbed 8 times, the rabbi asked people to do 8 good deeds. Also attending the rally was Boston Mayor Kim Janey, who tweeted Friday morning, "Please join me in lifting up Rabbi Noginsky in prayer this morning and wish him a speedy recovery. An attack on any member of our community is an attack on all of us in the city of Boston. We must work together to eliminate violence and fear in our communities." Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker also sent his best wishes to Noginsky, saying that there is no place for hate in Massachusetts, and we will always stand with our neighbors in the Jewish community in condemning every act of anti-Semitic violence. Calls for prayers and justice on behalf of Noginsky came from all over the world, including Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, who spoke with him and wished him strength and a speedy recovery. The Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations tweeted, "We're outraged by the brutal, unprovoked stabbing. Rabbi Noginsky bravely fought back and is thankfully in stable condition. We hope and pray he has a refuah shlema, a full and speedy recovery." Rabbi Moshe Hauer, Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union, said in the statement, "The horrific attack upon Rabbi Noginsky in the light of day and on the city street appears to be yet another in an unprecedented surge of attacks in recent months on American Jews. The growing frequency of these assaults indicates that perpetrators are not being deterred in targeting Jews for attack. Even worse, some politicians, celebrities, and other so-called influencers have been allowed to fan the flames of violence and hatred, justifying age-old anti-Semitic tropes, exaggerated claims, and inflammatory rhetoric." Well, that's a little bit about Rabbi Noginsky. Stabbed 8 times, survived, and is recovering. Really. Sitting on a bench outside of the school, and that's what happened to him. Let's continue on. This article I found kind of shocking by Jonah Cohen. He's talking about the public school curriculum in the state of Washington. They've now inserted the Israel-Palestine conflict into required fifth grade lessons on Native American history. Children as young as 10 are being taught to associate the Native curriculum called Since Time Immemorial, Tribal Sovereignty in Washington State, developed by the Tribal Leaders Congress on Education, the Washington State School Directors Association, and the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction. Subsequently, the curriculum was approved by use in 29 federally recognized tribes in Washington State. It's since been widely used in K-12 schools after state legislation in 2015 required the teaching of Native American history. The bizarre inclusion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict seems at odds with the curriculum's self-described place-based approach, in which teachers and students are supposedly encouraged to focus on the context of tribes in their own communities. Unfortunately, we're finding this sort of politicization of Israel in public schools across the U.S., according to Stephen Slotsky, who investigates bias in K-12 education for the CAMRA, International Student Leadership Institute. "In this case," he said, "I find it particularly troubling that the curriculum is being used by anti-Israel activists to divert attention away from Native American history. It's as unfair to Native Americans as it is to Jews. Ultimately, it will damage the credibility of the entire curriculum as people figure out what's going on." Troubled as well, I contacted the organization behind the curriculum. In response to my questions, a school official from Washington State Office of Native Education wrote me, quote, "To clarify the focus of the Since Time Immemorial curriculum lesson you're inquiring about, centers student learning around the understanding of the struggles Indian nations experienced with the founding of the U.S. colonies. The Israel-Palestine conflict is not the focus of the lesson," she said. "But although it's not the main focus, an assignment about Native Americans' revolts against European encroachment tells students that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a useful contemporary connection for understanding the Indian Wars for Independence. The assignment uses leading questions to teach that, like Native Americans, the Palestinians are struggling to have their, quote, sacred homelands returned to them. While it's true most Palestinian Arabs likely view their uprisings the same way, the ancient and unbroken Jewish presence in these same sacred lands is omitted from the lesson. There's no mention of the evidence of Jewish indigeneity or the need for a sovereign Jewish homeland in the violently intolerant Middle East. The assignment's language indicates the students will never hear anything about the archaeological and textual discoveries that place the Jewish people in the land approximately 2,000 years before the Arab-Islamic colonial incursions. Nor will students learn about the Jewish majority in Jerusalem dating back to the 1800s, or the genetic evidence indicating that most of the world's Jewish population can be traced back to the Levant. And most disturbingly, perhaps, the centuries-old oppression of Mizrahi Jewish communities in the Arab world, culminating in their brutal ethnic cleansing in the 20th century. It also left that out. Nearly a million Jewish refugees were compelled by these anti-Semitic atrocities to find refuge in Israel. Since students do not receive this information in the since time immemorial curriculum, those who complete the assignment will come away with it with two notions. First, Israelis are analogous to Europeans who overran another people's territory. And second, the ethical position is to side with the indigenous Palestinians in their fight to reclaim their sacred homeland from, can you guess, Jewish usurpers. True, the lesson does not explicitly assert either of those two propositions. The children are left to make the obvious inferences for themselves. But no school child will be able to avoid the curriculum's suggestion that Israelis are the intruder and Palestinians the victim. Those conclusions might not be a conscious deduction on the part of the child. The scandal behind the lesson is that it plays on the innocence of grade schoolers, all those boys and girls who think they're just doing their required Native American assignment, but have no clue of the controversial ethics, history, and politics of the Middle East being smuggled into it and into their subconscious. Any intellectually honest adult can see that this assignment is not an actual lesson on Jewish Arab history. It's the exploitation of Native American suffering in order to plant in the school child's mind an assumption about the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. In short, not a good education, but a form of political conditioning. This article is by Jonah Cohen, Communications Director for the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis, otherwise known as CAMRA. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see that we're running out of time. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining me today for readings of interest to the Jewish community. My name is Michael Wolman, and you are invited, of course, to please stay tuned for our next program. In parting, I'd like to wish everyone a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavua Tov. Have a good week.